Hello and welcome to our first LSESU Amnesty International podcast. I'm Carla, and in this series we'll be hearing from speakers within a range of different fields to discuss pressing human rights issues that they have expertise on, in order to further Amnesty's mission to raise awareness and broaden engagement with topics that need to be talked about. Today's episode will be a playback of a panel event hosted by our society's president, Ishika, in which we'll be hearing from three speakers on the topic of discrimination against LGBTQ plus people in healthcare, in the US, UK, and Indian context.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Without any further ado, to the introductions. So first we have Dr. Joanna Semlian. She is a public health specialist as well as a British Psychological Society chartered psychologist. Dr. Semlian's interdisciplinary research focuses on health inequalities and health disparities in sexual and gender minority populations. And she has a key insight on mental health. Her specific research papers on mental health for the LGBT plus community provide us with an insight about how they're disproportionately affected. And her Twitter account gives us a lot of good real-time updates. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Semlian.
Thank you.
Would you like to please tell us a bit about your research and what you're doing in this field?
I shall, thanks. So thank you very much for a lovely introduction and for inviting me today. I'm really delighted to be here. I've made it my intent really to focus specifically on UK specific research findings. I think it's important to try and get research when you can that is relevant to the context, bearing in mind all contexts are different. And also when I came to start looking at health outcomes, there weren't any available based on the fact that unless you have resources such as surveys at the national level that are collecting that kind of data, it's actually difficult to analyze and therefore you can't provide the evidence. So we got to a place where a series of national surveys started asking the question. They kind of got over themselves and started asking questions about sexual orientation. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, they created a harmonized question that has been used across a series of different surveys. Now, in and of themselves, none of those surveys provided a huge amount of data, but when we combined them together and we did an individual participant data meta-analysis, we were able to pull all that data and had enough numbers to draw conclusions down about a series of health outcomes across the disaggregated groups of L for lesbian, B, bisexual women. We also had B for bisexual men and gay men. So we had LB and GB data. That's very important because, of course, there are sex differences in those two groupings. So the research that I've done has looked at physical health outcomes, also health behaviours. So we've got increased smoking, we've got increased alcohol, hazardous alcohol use, and particularly there is increased levels of common mental disorder, which is across suicidality, depression, anxiety, as well as substance misuse in all LGB groups in comparison to heterosexuals in the UK. So that's really the underpinning of my work. And then I just, if you would like me to talk a little tiny bit to the question that was posed about the context and sort of really the health experience of our LGBTQ population. And of course, I'm very mindful that the UK is an extremely wealthy country. And there has been some political, shift in recent times, providing some rights, some increased rights for LGBTQ people. I always point out we must remember that even in the privileged position of the UK, and I'm very keen to point out that I consider the UK and the UK LGBTQ population to be in a very privileged position, there's still a huge amount of homo, bi and transphobia. And we have to always remember that the rights that we have are rights we won. And if we have won rights, we can also lose those rights. And we saw that over recently over in the US, which Logan can talk to, I'm sure, at great length. But they have pushback about rights that happened under the a recent president, can't remember his name, he's forgotten. So a couple of final points, really, because I'm very mindful of time. From my perspective, speaking from the UK, we do have a fantastic National Health Service, but we don't necessarily have professionals that are completely comfortable or understand, or who perhaps are not even supportive of LGBT people. And if they've either had an experience or they fear they're going to have a negative experience, they may that they don't want to attend those health services. So there is an argument that we could create, couldn't we, LGBT focused services, or very LGBT specific services. And that's, if we want to come back to the conversation later, we could, because there's advantages for one, which is training our mainstream, which is filled with expertise, but the other health expertise, of course, and then it's creating LGBT specific, because of course they might be a service that is going to be feel far more welcoming for an LGBT person. So there's those sort of thoughts to put out there. And then I guess as we go on through this conversation, I have some other ideas that I would want to share. But for now, I would like to make room for the other speakers, and then we can come back to pick up the other questions. I hope that's a good start, an interesting start for you.
That's a great start. Thank you so much. It's really interesting to see how specifically you go about doing your research. And I mean, the LGBTQ community, we talk about it as a monolith, but you have to really dive deep into the differences between, you know, how lesbian women and how it goes for, you know, bi women and bi men, things like that. So that's really interesting. Next, we have Dr. Prasad Dandekar joining us from India. He is a radiation oncologist at the Reliance Foundation, but he is also the founder of Health Professionals for Queer Indians, one of India's first organizations aimed at educating healthcare providers to the needs of of India's LGBTQ plus community. An oncologist in the field himself, Dr. Dandekar provides us with a valuable insight on how the doctor-patient relationship can be cultivated in a country which is still in the wake of decriminalizing homosexuality only a few years ago. We also want to especially thank Dr. Dandekar for attending this event in the midst of the pandemic and all his work as a healthcare professional currently working with COVID-19. So thank you very much for joining us today, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Ishika, and a big thanks to your organization for inviting all of us together. And it's just wonderful to meet Logan and Dr. Similian, just like awesome, their profiles are amazing. I am an oncologist, unlike Logan and Dr. Similian, who work full-time working for the LGBT community. I actually work for cancer patients. And work for LGBT community is something which I do on the side. So I initiated something called as a health professional for queer Indians, which with a specific aim to sensitize healthcare professionals to be healthcare needs of the LGBTQ community, because that has been a big need. And it sort of emerged from a very personal experience where the only time, in fact, in my life that I have been abused publicly for being gay was by a very senior doctor, colleague of mine, not just a senior doctor, a colleague of mine, publicly on Facebook. And it literally devastated me for a number of days. And through that, after you know, a while, when I recovered, this sort of idea came up that rather than blaming him for what he has done, how can I change that into something positive? So it comes, I believe that his behavior came from ignorance, and how can I tackle that ignorance? So that is how HPQI started. The another initiative that I run is called as Teenager, which is a support group for older gay men who are about the age of 50. And we have been doing that for now nearly 4 years this July, so more than 3.5 years. And that's been thriving quite well in India, and there's a lot of traction. And as a part of HPQI, we have conducted a number of conferences, primarily focusing on mental health, where we had, we collaborated with Indian Psychiatric Society of India, in India, and conducted multiple trainings. So it would be like, typically we would do it as a full day training session, and just sensitizing people. We even created a movie sort of sensitizing people around that. So that's the sort of work I have been doing. So it's more of on the ground work with the LGBT community in India.
Thank you very much for your insights on this matter. I'm Indian myself, so I thought it was really important to have different countries represented when we are talking about the LGBT community. So thank you for that. Moving on to our last speaker of the evening, we have Dr. Logan Casey joining us from the US. He is a political scientist and an advocate. He's a senior policy researcher and advisor at Movement Advancement Project, or MAP, and has also worked as a former researcher associate at the Harvard Opinion Research Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Casey's research on how discrimination of the LGBT plus community contribute to poor health outcomes gives us a framework to understand the LGBT plus experience by quantifying the so-called qualitative and ushering in much needed research in this field. So thank you, Dr. Casey, for joining us. We'd love to hear more about your work.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here and thankful for the opportunity, especially to talk about LGBTQ experiences in healthcare in across many countries. I think that's something that's often really left out of this conversation is we tend to look at it in silos within our own country, and that I think looking across comparative contexts gives us so much insight into both, you know, as was being said before, you know, recognizing what privileges we may have in our particular context, but also what other kind of worlds are possible for our communities wherever we are. So thank you. My personal background is in, my academic training was in political science, and so I am particularly interested in policy and how governments and policy can create outcomes both on a societal level and interpersonally, and for today's conversation as it relates to health. I, as you mentioned, worked at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health doing polling about people's experiences with healthcare and beliefs about health policy in the US. And part of that work was a series on discrimination in America, where we asked people about their actual personal experiences of discrimination across many areas of life, including in healthcare. And that work had nationally representative surveys of LGBTQ people in the US, as well as nationally representative survey samples of Black Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, men, women, Native Americans and others. So it was really a comprehensive study of many different groups in the country and their personal experiences with racism and sexism and anti-LGBTQ prejudice. So that work is all published in a open access journal, and I can put a link to that in the chat in a minute. But as you mentioned, the major findings are basically that there are extraordinarily high rates of discrimination that people continue to face in the US today, including LGBTQ people in the context of healthcare. And those experiences of discrimination lead to poor health outcomes, both individually and at a group level. And that can create a sort of chain reaction that I can talk about more later, where, especially if you're experiencing discrimination in healthcare, that will also lead many people to avoid seeking healthcare in the future. And so if the discrimination is both causing negative health impacts and causing you to avoid the healthcare that you might need to redress those negative health impacts, they just get worse and worse over time. And that leads to many of the health disparities that we see in vulnerable and marginalized communities across the US. So that was some of that work. At MAP, my current position, I work more on the policy side than the health side, but much of our policy work about LGBTQ people includes policy related to healthcare. So let me back up for a second and tell you about MAP. We are a nonprofit think tank focusing on LGBTQ equality, but we've also been working outside the LGBTQ space specifically in recent years, including in some areas on voting and gun safety, which is a huge health concern here in the US. And MAP does this work through a couple different ways. One is policy, and that's most of what I work on. We also work on messaging and then what we call movement capacity and collaboration. And so that's really working across different movements and within the LGBTQ movement in the US to assess the strength of progressive movements and build collaboration across different movements to expand our capacity in advocating for better and more equitable outcomes and policy. So I work on the policy side, including tracking almost 40 different laws and policies related to LGBTQ people and experiences at the federal, state, and local levels. And then we use that research about policy to understand what are the major issues shaping LGBTQ people's experiences in the country, and what are the policy interventions that could change those outcomes. So I'll stop there for now.
Thank you very much, Dr. Casey. I think you've highlighted some really incredibly important points about how personal experience is incredibly important to notice. And even within the context of the US, there are so many other factors that really influence how the LGBT community is treated, and you know, the intersectionality if you're a Native American and part of the LGBT community, and how that could potentially impact you. So without any further ado, I think we can jump straight into the panel discussion. So the general aim of this event is to understand what healthcare is like for the LGBT plus community across different regions and cultures, hence the diverse panel. So we'll be trying to cover topics such as mental health, doctor-patient relationships, inequalities in policies, and how this ties in to the overall subject matter, which is the healthcare for the LGBT plus community. So my first question to the panel as a whole is, in your opinion and in your country, what is the single biggest problem for LGBT plus patients with regards to accessing healthcare?
I wish I could tell you what is the single biggest problem, because there are so many of them. It's very difficult to choose the single biggest. Before we even dive into the details of it, I just want to highlight for the reader that while we are discussing healthcare for the LGBT community across the globe, we need to remember one very important thing, that the LGBT community itself, LGBTQ plus community itself, is extremely diverse. And across the globe, even in countries such as US and India, not so much in the UK, I guess, the countrywide diversity is extreme. Like, you know, in India, if you are sitting in Mumbai versus you are sitting in somewhere else, it's going to be a completely different experience. So we need to keep in mind that there is a huge amount of diversity. And what we are discussing is at a fairly generic and superficial level today. The problem that we face in India is mainly visibility and knowledge. The visibility of LGBT community in India is very, very low because of the stigma attached to it. When I started organizing conferences for healthcare professionals, the first question which almost everybody asked me is, why do I need to attend? I never see gay people in my clinic. And I said, if you take the wide belief that around 5 to 8% of people are gay, you're seeing those 5 to 8 people, maybe if you see 100 patients a day, you're seeing those people. They are not telling you that they are from the LGBT community. It doesn't mean that they don't exist. You don't know it. So visibility is a big problem. And the second is knowledge, that the doctors or nurses or other healthcare professionals don't know what to do with these people. The reason is because there is lack of visibility, there is no training. Like, for example, when I trained 25 years ago as a medical student, in our books, it was actually written that homosexuality is an aberration. It is a mental health problem. Now, from there, to moving to acceptance and knowledge is a huge jump. So that's one big problem that we are facing. And that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to work on in my own small way.
Yeah, thank you. I did hold back actually, because I think it's useful to follow on from something that's quite different for me to make my point. And also that I love the fact that I can echo and agree that one of the reasons that's quite a difficult question to answer is because there isn't actually a single answer to that. It's such a complex interwoven issue. And I don't think anybody would probably disagree with that. If I was forced to choose something, and I did decide while Prasad was talking, I did think about what would I like to make a point about. I think for the UK, I think that we are past certain barriers to some extent, but probably one of the biggest issues is about disclosure of one's but think about sexual minorities as an example. It's slightly easier just to focus on that for this example. The disclosure of sexuality is quite a big problem in terms of, partly there is a fear of that disclosure is going to lead to a negative outcome. So the person is choosing either to not disclose, which means they're carrying some psychological burden every time they're in any kind of health environment, environment, or by disclosing, they're talking to somebody perhaps who isn't knowledgeable, and then they're educating that healthcare professional, which means they're not getting healthcare, they're giving an education. Or as I mentioned when I was speaking previously, I touched on the fact that this fear of disclosure and the all those issues around that, that they think something's going to happen, even if it hasn't already happened to them, might mean that an LGBT person might actually not attend for healthcare. And if you think about us as an example today, we're in the midst of a pandemic, you know, admittedly, we don't have capacity in our hospitals anyway. That aside, if you want to present, perhaps with, because you need some support, you're not feeling well, even in a global pandemic, our LGBT community are thinking twice about reaching out and making, you know, and actually making contact. And my final point, I want to just give you an example that I think links to mortality. And I think this is when we have to really take LGBT health seriously. If we have a scenario, and we do have a paramedic service in all of our countries, even though we have lots of very different contexts. I know that in this country, there are couples right now, let's say an older lesbian couple, and that one of that couple experiences, let's say, something very serious, like a stroke or a heart attack. Is that partner going to ring the ambulance, or are they, and I know this to be true anecdotally, are they first so anxious about being discovered to be a lesbian that before they ring for the ambulance, they spend 2 or 3 minutes trying to make their private home space, the one place where we can all be ourselves, something that doesn't put them in any way at risk of receiving prejudicial treatment at the arrival of the ambulance, meaning they may delay for an actual emergency intervention just because of a fear of disclosure. So I think that's probably where I'd like to end my response.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything that's already been said. There's no single problem in the US either. Everything that's been mentioned already is a problem here too. I think if I had to pick one single biggest problem in the US, and this wouldn't be just for LGBTQ people here, but for everyone here, is that our current system in the US is not a, you know, national insurance program, or what's derisively referred to here often as socialized medicine, but rather is based on a capitalistic and often for-profit system that means people's access to healthcare is mediated through their employment status, their ability to access health insurance. And so that system creates dramatically unequal access to healthcare, that those disparities exist along racial lines and class lines, geographic lines. Different parts of the country have different access to healthcare and health insurance. And of course, for LGBTQ people, and let alone if you're at the intersections of any of those identities, if you're both a person of color and an LGBTQ person, those disparities just compound. And so I think that the way that our entire system is designed here is the source of many of the problems. But setting that aside, like, we in the US, this is the system we're in for the moment. For the LGBTQ community, I think both, you know, the things that have been discussed already about disclosure and training, the lack of visibility, I think those are all clear issues here. I would also say that discrimination, both in the law and interpersonally, are a huge problem in the US context, that there's, because of the way our government structure works as well, there's the federal government that oversees, you know, national politics, but then there are also our 50 states, the District of Columbia, 5 US territories, each of which have their own system of government, and then local governments within that. And that federalism, the layering of all of those different governments, means that there are dramatically different government structures and bureaucracies in place in each one of those different states and localities. And so the lack of a federal coordinated and clear and explicit legislation saying discrimination against LGBTQ people in many contexts, but in this context, healthcare, the absence of that means that there's even further variation in LGBTQ people's experiences above and beyond what the capitalist based system here is creating. I can talk a lot more about any of those things, but I'll stop for now.
I think that's a perfect segue for our next question then. So it seems like there are many problems, and they seem to be, you know, in the case of India, having a lot to do with, you know, the cultural context, what it is like to be part of the LGBT community, whereas in the US, Dr. Casey, you mentioned the overall capitalistic system under which we all, you know, tend to walk in. So there should be some light at the end of the tunnel. So what policy measures or programs can help us overcome these problems? And to what extent is your country specifically making progress towards implementing this, if at all? Do you think there's been any landmark policy event or instance that has helped us take the step in the right direction? It's a very large, long-winded question, but we'll start with Dr. Casey first.
Sure. I want to say, I think, you know, even as we're seeing in the UK, there's not even a national insurance program. It's not the answer or solution to everything. And there are many problems in the implementation, but just big, big different starting point in terms of at least access into healthcare in the first place. But in the US, recent measures that have helped under President Obama, there was a very notable policy called the Affordable Care Act that dramatically expanded healthcare access in the US, particularly for lower income communities across the country, and dramatically increased the rate of people with health insurance here. And one provision of that law is called Section 1557. And what it does is it is the sort of legislation that I was talking about, saying we need an explicit federal declaration that discrimination against LGBTQ people is illegal in healthcare. And this isn't that explicit, but it's the closest thing that we've come to so far. And so what it did say was that it's illegal for healthcare providers that receive money from the federal government to refuse to treat someone or otherwise discriminate against them because of their race or their color, their age or disability, or their sex. And there was guidance that said the term sex should be understood to apply to sexual orientation and gender identity. And so that's as close as we've gotten so far. But because of the federalism that I mentioned before and the interaction between the federal and state governments, particularly in the administration of healthcare, means that different states still interpret that or enforce that law differently. And so we're still getting an unequal enforcement of even the federal guidance that does exist. So that's a past thing that did make a very big difference. And we actually saw, it was a step, but not all the way. And we did actually see a number of states, as a result of that guidance, issuing proactive guidance to their state saying, you know, that means you cannot, just being even more explicit than the federal guidance was, you cannot discriminate in these ways. You can't refuse to cover healthcare for transgender people just because they're transgender. So there's a number of proactive things that came out of that guidance. Something that we are currently looking toward in the US is something called the Equality Act. And it is the federal legislation that I'm really talking about, where it doesn't just say because of sex, which you should interpret to mean this, this, and this. And it's not just a bureaucratic guidance, even though that's very important and has the force of law. This is an actual law that would go through Congress that the president would sign. And it explicitly says discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity is illegal in many contexts, including healthcare nationwide. And so we're really hopeful that now that there's a new president, this bill will finally become law, but there are still a number of obstacles, particularly in the Senate here, but that's something that would really be a huge, huge change for the LGBTQ community here.
Yeah, do you mind if I come in there? Because it's a natural follow-on to say that the UK has the Equality Act 2010. So we are sort of 10 years down the line from that. So it's very interesting to hear what you were saying there, Logan. And we have 9 protected characteristics within that. And it is legislation, and you can prosecute, for example, hate crime. It is possible to, there are laws around equality to access to goods and services. So there's a lot of legislation in place. And I think that's made a huge difference in terms of the sense that there is a legislative layer of protection. The 9 protected characteristics, I just pulled them up very quickly so I didn't make a mistake in my list, because it's it might be of interest, is age, disability, gender reassignment. Because I heard you say that sex should apply to gender and sexuality. You know, we have to be very clear about what we mean by these terms. So we have age, disability, gender reassignment, marriage and civil partnership, pregnancy and maternity, race, controversial word, religion or belief, sex, and sexual orientation. So these are all quite specific. Of course, there's lots and lots of confusion about people often conflate gender identity, gender and sex, sexual orientation and gender identity. There's multiple ways and people are very confused. So it doesn't necessarily help in some ways, but it is very, very important to mention that legislation. And one of those things is about protection of a person's right to have equal access to services. So for example, a GP, a primary care doctor in the UK, I'm using that as an example because I did some research that was around gay Muslim men and accessing GPs. So it was very interesting, very specific example. But you know, as a gay Muslim man, one should be able to be treated as the same as the straight guy or the straight Christian guy or whoever it was that went in just before them, right? So those are the kinds of, that's a very, very simple legislative right that offers you the power, I suppose, if you have that. But it's still, the onus is still very much on the individual to act, but there is still that legislation. And I think that's I do think that's worthy of note. And that's something that's very, very important that the UK brought into place. And I can't show you any evidence of how it's made a difference, because I don't work in sort of the way in which you describe your research is around sort of the impact of policy. And of course, I'm telling you today, there's a paper out that shows that, you know, people's mental health is still, LGBT mental health is still, you know, hasn't really particularly improved.
We have to get it decriminalized. And now that the whole battle is over, there's a bit of chaos because now people don't know what to fight with, because there's so much to do. There's health, there is social security, there's marriage equality, and there are so many other issues that are happening. So there's a bit of a confusion. We're going through still the shock of being, not being criminal. And the path that people have chosen is now there is a court case happening in the High Court about gay marriages. So there is some work happening, but from health point of view, you're not really moved forward anywhere. And as I mentioned, that the visibility is something that will help us in that direction gradually.
Okay, perfect. So now moving on to some of the underlying issues, I just wanted to understand, so to what extent do you think cultural factors affect the inequality in the healthcare systems for LGBT plus communities? And how do you think that, you know, homophobia and transphobia seep into doctor-patient relationships specifically? We can start with Dr. Prasad, please.
Yeah, so as a clinician, I see this one-on-one. And as you're aware, the Indian culture is very diverse. And we often forget that doctors are as human as their patients are. And we have biases, and most of those biases are invisible to us. So you have no idea what your biases are. That creates one problem. So in India, for example, if you look at transgender community, there's a particular subsection of transgender community, which is part of, one could call it religious sect or, a particular faction called Hijra community. Now, they probably get the worst of it because these are people who are not maybe financially doing very well, so they don't have good access to healthcare, and plus their appearance will make it even more difficult for them to access healthcare. And there is definitely an element of maybe a bit of a transphobia, homophobia that seeps in. And it will take some time for the healthcare professionals in India to move forward. One of the things that really helped during the battle for decriminalization was the Indian Psychiatric Society came forward and issued a very, very clear letter supporting this battle, saying that homosexuality must be decriminalized and it is not a mental health disorder. And that was very widely shared, and HPQI was quite instrumental in not just getting this letter, but also sort of spreading the word around. And that has changed things quite a lot on the ground. Now people are saying that, okay, so it's not that bad. And one of the drive home messages of the conferences that I have been doing, where we talk about all the aspects for the whole day, in my request to the doctors and the counselors and mental health workers at the end of the day, is that if you want to take one thing home today, is just that when anybody walks into your clinic, please don't assume that they are heterosexual. Just keep your mind open. And that's a good starting point for you to have. And that is what will then widen your mind. And as you, then you will start questioning, is this, because a married man may come in and come for treatment for infertility, and you would experiment on the wife first, because that's how the Indian culture would work, but not question the sexuality of the man. So that's one thing that that's how the culture is going to impact everything that happens to the LGBTQ community.
Would any other panelists like to jump in?
Sure. I think Dr. Dandekar's point is spot on, that doctors and providers are people too, and we grow up in the societies that we grow up in and are taught whatever biases are specific to those places. And that can change not just from one country to the next, but very much within a country or in different communities within that country. And so all of those factors play into doctor-patient relationships here in the US, and they can change a lot in different parts of the country. I think, some of the same examples of the questions that doctors and providers may or may not ask their patients, prescriptions that they may or may not be willing to write, referrals they may or may not be willing to give, and just the general training that medical schools and training in the US, what those programs do and don't include. I know that there's a growing movement, there has been for some time, but it's still not nationally consistent, about LGBTQ related competency training for people in medical school and as part of continuing medical education. And oftentimes what will happen is that, to the extent those programs do exist, they are optional or voluntary. And so the people who are already thinking proactively about, I need to be better about my ability to treat lots of different kinds of people, the people who are, so those are the folks who are already probably doing somewhat well and know that they need to seek out more help. The training is going to them, which is great. Everybody should get this training, but then the folks who probably need it the most are the ones who are not going. So I think that's one of the ways that can come into the healthcare system at an interpersonal level. And I think there's also a big issue in the US and probably in many other places about the role of religion in the healthcare system and in the government more broadly. And there's nothing inherent about religion that is bad, of course, or discriminatory, or that even that might not have a role to play in medicine and in healthcare. Obviously, religion and our spiritual practices and beliefs can have a huge impact on people's physical and mental health and their connection to community and the world around them. So there's nothing inherently bad about religion, but in the US, religion is often used as a way to not provide equal access or resources for some people. And so here in the US, there's a growing set of laws that we refer to as religious exemptions, which basically means that even if you're in a place where there are non-discrimination laws that say you can't discriminate against someone because of that they're a woman or they're a person of color or you're an LGBTQ person, these religious exemption laws allow people to not adhere to that law. And so if they have an objection based on their religious beliefs, whatever they may be. And so in practice, what that means is that It is perfectly legal in some states in the US for a doctor or a pharmacist or nurse, or even just someone working in a healthcare setting, even if they're not a medical provider themselves, like a secretary or an administrator, that they could just refuse to work with an LGBTQ person because they don't want to, which is awful in any circumstance, but particularly in light of a global pandemic that, you know, as we mentioned before, hospitals are already at capacity. And if you're then allowing people to pick and choose who they want to treat, this introduces an opportunity for bias to play a role in who's getting refused care. Not that anybody should be refused care, but just there's another place where that comes into play in the US healthcare system. So religious exemptions are a big area of law and policy that we're currently struggling with.
Great.
I just wanted to come in on the end of that. Firstly, to say how shocking it is that one sets up, this is like a layer of, isn't it? It's a layer of equal rights that is then, there's some kind of hierarchy as if God trumps all, whatever God is, you know, in any religious context. So to firstly, just to say how abhorrent I find that and how difficult that is. And I'm sure that there are quiet ways in which, perhaps because of religious belief, there are some people perhaps in the UK who are sideways stepping, providing treatment, but it wouldn't be allowed formally. I put up a paper because which I touched on before, which actually explores this intersection between culture and sexuality and health. And just one final thing, the training, GBT competency training within medicine, I'm based within a medical school. And it's, you know, we've managed to get one session into the timetable, which is mandatory for all, you know, the first years now. But it's still very difficult. And these sessions, these sort of LGBT or diversity sessions, are often tokenistic, single sort of drop-ins, or as you described, Logan, sort of, you know, voluntary. And I'm minded that I'm the lead for diversity and inclusion in the school. I can't tell you how many emails I get sent to me saying, there's a talk on something to do with diversity, perhaps you'd like to go. This idea that diversity and inclusion is only my job. I'm doing it on behalf of everybody else. It's frightening. But anyway, so those were a few things I just wanted to add at the end of having listened to Prasad and Logan there.
Okay, thank you very much. I think now we had a few more questions, but I think we should move into the Q&A section because a lot of our participants have some really good questions. So I think we can start off with Inika McCombie's point. I think Inika is joining us from the UK. Could you address how queer couples are treated during fertility treatments or IVF processes, etc., if any of the speakers would like to weigh in?
Sure, I can. In the US context, this is another example of how our system, which is often based in for-profit models, really fails to serve people equitably, and including LGBTQ people. And so there are a number of states and insurance companies that basically allow for insurance companies to refuse to cover healthcare related to fertility treatments, or for trans people fertility preservation efforts, or anything really like that. And so as with many things in the US, individuals or couples' ability to access that kind of care is often dependent on where you live and or how much money you have to pay for that kind of service, including going to a private setting if your insurance won't pay for it for you, or even share the cost. There are some states that are working to pass legislation that says, insurance companies, you're not allowed to do that. You have to cover IVF. You have to cover fertility treatments. If you would cover it for a different sex couple, you have to cover it for same-sex couples, or you just have to cover it in general if you offer it at all. So there is work being done on that front, but because of the variation across states and the politics in different states and the demographics of different states, that's another thing where there's a lot of variation. So it's not great, but we're working on it. That's a short answer.
I'm happy to talk from the UK perspective. I was also just trying to get myself up to speed on this because I'm a little, it's not my field, but I do know that, I can tell you that, of course, under the NHS, couples are, or single people now, therefore, if you like, sexuality irrelevant, are able to have a certain number of cycles of IVF. There was occasions when we have, although we have a united, kingdom, a national health service, of course, we have devolved, the four devolved countries within that. And of course, there are what's called the, what we have here is a, what's called a postcode lottery, which means that it will depend actually what your CCG is, your sort of local commissioning group, like a district, I suppose. So there is some variation. Really, there is a very strong argument. Money helps in lots of ways, sadly. So if you have money, you can go and pay. I mean, there is a massive, massive money-making machine around fertility clinics. And so there's even one of these sort of, what are they called? Like an exhibition show, like the fertility show. And you turn up and there's, you know, all sorts of companies there all over the world offering, you know, and if you have the money, you can pay for it. So if we have lack of socioeconomic equity within the LGBT community versus the heterosexual community, then arguably there's going to be lower access, isn't there, to those kinds of things because of money. But beyond that, I don't know the nuanced information enough to know whether it is pitted again, you know, there is an actual lack of equity within the NHS if you turn up, because under the Equality Act, you should be entitled, as I've said, to the same treatment as a heterosexual. And I have to say that's as much as I know. If the person that asked the question knows, they could always chip in because they may know something else having asked the question. I'd be interested to hear myself. But I don't know if Prasad wanted to come in on that one as well. I'll be interested to hear how India's handling IVF treatment for lesbians. I'd be very interested, if at all.
So in India, we have a very divided healthcare system. We have public healthcare system, which is run by government, which forms the majority part of the healthcare system. And then we have the private healthcare system, which itself is a huge part of the system. Most of the IVF would be catered by the private system, where one would have to pay from pocket or through insurance, private insurance. And we had very relaxed laws about IVF and surrogacy until recently. I think 3-4 years ago, the law changed. And I, for one, know that the organization where I used to work earlier, we used to get a lot of gay couples coming from outside India for surrogacy because it was so much easier and it was almost like it was a very good business. And then the Indian government tightened the laws, and now all of that has stopped. So because we still don't have any policy on how the government and the institution should behave with LGBTQ individuals, we still don't have clear policy on fertility or IVF issues.
Okay, great. So I think it's a really interesting point to see how, you know, couples would come to India for such kind of treatments. I don't think that would have been my own understanding of the situation earlier. I guess we can move on to the next question then, which comes from Gabby Santos. I was wondering about private healthcare providers and clinics that cater to the LGBT community. To what extent do these providers help or hinder access? What's been the experience in the different regions represented in our panel today?
I can start with an interesting sort of thing that I would say at the beginning of my conferences. And, you know, I told you that it would be very difficult for me to convince people that they should come and attend our sensitization conferences. And I would always start the conference by telling them, don't do it for your patients. Don't do it for the community. Don't do it for the country. Do it for yourself. Get yourself some pink dollar. Because if you treat LGBTQ plus individuals well, if you are nice to them, you treat them well, you understand what to do with them, they're going to come back to you. They're going to refer their friends to you. And your income is going to increase, so do it for your own good sake. And that would work most of the time, I would hope so. So the private institutions or private clinics, I guess, would be interested in India, I'm talking in Indian perspective, if, you know, you have to tell them what's in it for them, right? I mean, it's difficult to imagine that people would do things very differently for the greater good. Ideally, they should, but you know, we are human. So the way I put across things is, I always tell in any aspect of my life, what's in it for you? You know, what are you going to get out of this? And it has to be a win-win situation. You know, we look forward to things changing in India where the private healthcare would accept these changes much faster than the government healthcare.
Yeah, in the US context, that's a wonderful question. So when I read that question about private clinics that cater to LGBTQ community, the first thing that came to my mind was about how that works differently for queer folks in urban versus rural settings. And so those LGBTQ specific clinics or medical centers in the US, they are most commonly located in really big cities like Chicago and Boston and San Francisco and DC. And they are incredibly wonderful for many, many, including that they provide the sort of tailored healthcare that, you know, you can go and get the doctors and providers who have the competency that we're talking about many, many providers don't have today, that you will be treated the way that you want to be treated. They also are often centers of excellence for research and promoting best practices and education for other medical providers. So they're really, really wonderful in a number of ways. And they provide access to people living in that general area. The problem in the US context becomes that those centers do so well in these urban settings, but they aren't serving the broader community, just geographically speaking. And in an effort to address that, what people often do is try to take those LGBTQ specific settings or clinics and set them up in different contexts, like in a more rural area, where visibility means something really, really different, that you might not want to be seen in a more rural context going to the LGBTQ clinic. That can have different impacts for you in that setting. And we've done a whole series of research at MAP about LGBTQ people in rural areas in the US and highlighting the many, many wonderful things about that and trying to dispel stereotypes about that it's so awful to be LGBTQ in rural areas. So don't hear me saying that, just hear me say that the context of being queer in a rural space in the US is a lot different than being queer in an urban space. And so that means different things about what healthcare providers and things like LGBTQ specific healthcare clinics or providers, how that works differently. And so what we end up recommending based on research and interviews with people in rural areas is less of a, like, let's do an LGBT center in a rural setting to get all the queer people in rural areas, but really instead work on the training of doctors that already exist there to amplify the training and the quality for, you know, the doctors that are already there that are seeing the broader community in rural settings and really building the sort of infrastructure on the rural front.
May I ask a follow-up question on this, please? So, Dr. Casey, you mentioned about the problems of rural versus, you know, urban and the, you know, setting up this clinic. Now, one thing that the pandemic has helped us to deal with is bringing technology to healthcare. And a lot of us, doctors, as well as patients, healthcare providers who are very uncomfortable with technology are now doing that. Do you think use of this sort of technology, whether it is virtual consultations or any other forms of technology, would change the picture for the LGBT community in terms of access to healthcare?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think absolutely broader access to healthcare via telemedicine and other technology tools would be a dramatic improvement for queer people in the US, especially in rural areas. One of the issues, of course, is that there are, at least in the US, infrastructure issues with having access to the internet, high-speed internet and the technology that people would need to be able to actually access those tools to get healthcare. So that's something that continues to be a priority for many folks in the US. But you know, I think something that we're seeing is the way that the adaptations that we're all making as a result of COVID, including the increasing use of technology and webinars and digital services, is helping many people that they couldn't, that we couldn't reach before. And so we see LGBTQ community centers in the US are dramatically increasing their online services, which means that they're now able to, even if they're based in, that center is based in an urban area, they're now able to reach more people in rural areas that maybe wouldn't have been able to drive to meet them, to go there before. And so we're already seeing it helping folks in rural communities, but there's still the pre-existing issue of access to the internet and the actual physical, like the economic issues that mean maybe I can't afford the phone or the laptop that would let me access telehealth.
I was just going to come in and respond to the original question from Gabby. Firstly, to say I think it's a brilliant question, actually, and it's not one that I've had put in front of me before. So well done on the question. From the UK perspective, there is very little in terms of private health that is aimed at LGBT people per se, apart from probably mental health services. So I'm going to talk to those after a passing comment that as long as these kind of LGBTQ clinics are staffed with fully trained people, I have no problem with if somebody wants to access that. When it comes to provision of private mental health care, I do think there's an awful lot we have to think about. We have, of course, lots and lots of concerns around conversion therapy, and that is still happening. Certainly, we need to make sure that there are standards for private health, private mental health provision. So in the UK, many, many people set themselves up as a psychologist or a psychotherapist or a therapist or a counsellor with almost no qualifications. We have a very strict training, but it seems that anybody could just set themselves up and give them a nice web page and just say they're something about themselves and take on clients. So that's a worry. There's also, of course, all the faith-based sort of therapy that's happening, but that's slightly off the topic. But there's no sort of governance around that. And then there's the important governance we need, even for people who are part of our regulatory bodies, like the BPS, the BACP, the UKCP. All of the different regulatory bodies, we still have to manage and make sure that this kind of private therapy, which is hugely accessed. I mean, I have a paper from 2007 that showed that LGBT people are accessing mental health more and having more sessions in therapy than heterosexuals and cisgendered. So we know that there's a higher use, but what are we doing to make sure and ensure the quality of that mental health service provision? And that, I think, is a very, very important issue. Again, what training are they having? What part of their training has got integrated, non-tokenistic training around LGBTQ people, and how actually offer truly affirmative mental health care? Yeah, so affirming of somebody's identity, and not, for example, making somebody's mental health be not about them being depressed, but about them being queer, right? So I think I'll end on that I feel sort of passionately about that and have written much about the kind of recommendations to be making sure that that is monitored carefully. And I really think a lot more needs to be done around that. So that's all for now. Thank you. Great question.
Thank you so much. And I think this would be a great place to end the discussion today with the passion that Dr. Semlian has brought us with. I would want to thank all of our speakers just once again for joining us today and being part of this discussion. Personally, I've really appreciated learning a lot about how dissimilar but also similar these contexts actually are, and how a lot of the problems that can be faced have similar cultural roots, even though they exist in such different and distinct economic and political situations. We've had some great resources shared in the chat today. So I've taken a list of all of them and I'll be sharing them on social media as well as with our speakers, just to ensure that we keep this conversation going. I'd like to just remind everyone on this call today that we are going to continue our campaign as the LSE Amnesty International Society on healthcare. And next month we'll be focusing entirely on mental health. And thank you to our wonderful panelists, and thank you for joining us today. We hope you've learned something. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.